like to introduce our speaker today, Professor Paul Mariani, who has had a long and distinguished career as a poet and biographer as well. There's a wonderful narrative biography on our website that I won't take the time to read, but it tells a lot of his own history and his scholarly accomplishments as well. Among many other things, Professor Mariani is the author of over 200 essays, scholarly essays, and is it 14 books now? 16 books now, including, I think, six books of poetry.
Yes.
And many other critical volumes, including most recently and impressively a biography of Sherard Manley Hopkins, about whom I hope we'll hear quite a bit about today. He's University Professor of Poetry here at Boston College, and it's a great honor to have such a distinguished poet and professor with us today. His title for today is Giving the Dead Their Living Voices, On Writing Biography. So thank you so much for being here.
Sure. Thank you very much for the great introduction. Well, folks, we're going to be talking about 40 years here of writing. The Gerard Manley Hopkins, which just came out this month, from Viking, is the fifth of five biographies. Just to give you a little background, I've done biographies of four American poets, and then this. William Carlos Williams was the first, followed by John Berryman, followed by Robert Lowell, followed by Hart Crane, and now my oldest love, going back to my very first book, which was my dissertation, and then revised into a commentary on the complete poems of Gerard Manley Hopkins, which Cornell University Press brought out back in 1970. But that was the age of the kind of new criticism. So one looked at the text rather than at the life. And I've always been fascinated by the correlation between the writing and the life that wrote that. You know, that was responsible for that poetry or fiction or whatever. And I promised myself that at some point I would come back to Hopkins and do a full-fledged biography of the man. He's had, I think, the deepest and most profound impact on my own life. I could go into that later, but I don't mean just as a poet, but I mean as a presence. I mean as a Jesuit presence. It's one of the reasons, it's probably one of the major reasons I'm here at Boston College, is because of this relationship to Gerard Manley Hopkins. So it's that personal. I know that when I've been teaching Hopkins in seminars and in general classes, I always began my courses in modern poetry with Hopkins, Dickinson, Whitman, and Hardy as kind of proto-moderns, and then I would move into William Carlos Williams and Wallace Stevens and Ezra Pound and Marion Moore and Art Crane, et cetera, T.S. Eliot. But I always began with those as the proto-moderns. So Hopkins was always always there. I think, if I may, one of the major turning points for me in terms of finally coming to write this biography was a 30-day Jesuit retreat that I made at Gloucester back in January and February of 2000. I had been, in fact, it's funny how these things come about, but I'd been asked by the editor at Viking to write about that experience from the perspective of a layman, because there were many, many books, you know, by spiritual directors on the 30 days, but they wanted to see what the experience was like by someone who was attracted to it, but who himself or herself was not a Jesuit. And I remember going to, this was up at Eastern Point in Gloucester, and it was winter, it was a cold winter, and I didn't bring Hopkins with me. All I brought was the Bible and the spiritual exercises. Okay, I was going to do it straight. And I remember my director saying, "You love Hopkins, where's your Hopkins?" And so he said, "Here, I want you to read Hopkins." So he gave me his paperback edition of Hopkins, which was a real blessing, because as the 30 days unfolded, many things that I'd read many, many times, including Hopkins' sermons and then his spiritual writings and the poetry, like the Record of Deutschland, in fact, all of the poetry, suddenly took on a new direction for me, a deeper understanding. I could see that Hopkins had been deeply shaped by the spiritual exercises. I mean, he really was deeply formed as a Jesuit. And now I understood that. And I came away from that with an understanding that the poetry, in fact, that is the mature poetry. He had written as an undergraduate when he was at Balliol College at Oxford. And that tradition comes out of his Anglican background. That really comes out of, say, his understanding of figures like the metaphysicals, especially Herbert. George Herbert, I think, was most important to him at that level. He always admired Herbert and continued to go back to him, and in fact would insert lines from Herbert into his own work. And then Christina Rossetti was also very important to him as a contemporary. But then the poetry underwent a radical transformation, I think, in terms of depth, almost a kind of electrical charge to the poetry. He had, in fact, burned most of his poetry when he became a priest. Now, that was a Jesuit priest, or entered the Jesuit order, I should say. And that was nothing that the Jesuits told him to do. This was just his own. He felt he had to do this. So he didn't ask anybody. He just burned it and then wrote a little notation in his journals, Slaughter of the Innocents, okay, to speak about that experience. Because for him, in many ways he was hard on himself. He was a real ascetic as well as a very sensuous man. So you have these two sides fighting or struggling or in tension with each other all of his life. Someone who loved nature, was a romantic poet, and at the same time was drawn to the ascetic, and even mystical life, I would say. I'll talk about that, but I really think that he was moving in that direction. And then, after years of silence, pretty much, except for one or two occasional pieces that he wrote for the Jesuits, for example, when there would be a gathering, he wrote a piece called Consulate Jones, which they just discovered a few years ago. And it gives us a different sense of Hopkins. It shows Hopkins the comic side of Hopkins. He's a funny man, and that's one of the things that with Hopkins has been often given short shrift, that just how witty he was, just how funny the man could be in that grand Victorian manner. And I'm glad that Joe Feeney, for example, has just come out with a book detailing the many, 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 many places where you have this comic side of Hopkins. And one of the things I wanted to do was, I remember Father Bill Leahy asking me, he says, did he get along with the Jesuits? You know, because there's this sense that he was isolated from the Jesuits. And the truth is, he was very well loved by the Jesuits. He was eccentric, yeah, but then what Jesuit is not? With all their puns and the rest of it. Including my own son who suffers from that, from a kind of, you know, pun-ridden. But he was also well-loved. And Joe Rickaby, for example, who had known Hopkins all those years, when Joe Rickaby was in a kind of old age home in Wales, in fact, the same place that had been Theologate before, that where Hopkins had written the Record of Deutschland, Joe Rickaby said, you know, no one was more loved than Hopkins. He was a funny man, but he was also a very serious man. And I wanted to bring that side out in Hopkins because it had been, as I say, not addressed in the other biographies. If I can go on to that, for example, the last biography that was written by Hopkins was written by an avowed atheist. Now, that's a difficult combination to get inside, you know, someone like Hopkins if, in fact, you're already sort of, you know, Norman White at University College Dublin would begin his book by saying, you know, let's realize, folks, Hopkins is dead. He's dead. You know, they buried him and he's in Glasnevin Cemetery, and we don't even know where he is because there are no crosses or anything. He's just dead. So let's take that and now let's talk about him. Well, that gives a kind of dark perspective on Hopkins. I think Hopkins is very much alive. I think Hopkins was alive with me there at Gloucester. I just, like a communion of saints in a sense, I could talk to him. And he would, you know, and he helped me. So it's just a different take on the two lives. But I wanted to bring out a book that would show us Hopkins both as a Jesuit and as a major poet of the entire 19th century. That was what I was out to do. And I wanted to write it as much as possible from inside. Now, let me just talk a little bit about inside. I've done this with every one of my biographies. I've tried to write them from inside. And that's a risky thing to do, because it means you've got to be, quote, a master ventriloquist. It means you've got to know the figure so well that you can actually almost begin to think for the figure that you're doing. And yet you've got to convince your audience that what you're doing makes sense. You know, because if the ventriloquist moves his lips too much, you no longer trust the ventriloquist, right? So it's got to be there, but it's got to be done in a kind of expert, or as well, as close to expert as you can make it. So you have to really, it takes years. It really takes years. And it means literally typing in all the poems. It means typing in the letters. It means until finally the very breath pauses and the very way that the figure that you're writing thinks gets into your bloodstream somehow. You know, I mean, and you're not ready to write until you've done that. Now, you can write an objective piece. I mean, you could write a piece for one of the dictionary, you know, dictionary of literary biography, something of that nature. And you could do an objective piece, but it would be from the outside. It would be the facts, and it would born in such and such a date, died in such and such a date, taught at such and such a place, did this, did that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Is well known for the 26 books that he or she published. That kind, you can do that. But that doesn't give you the living, breathing, you know, interior life. That the biographer, I think, if the biographer is going to be successful, has to give you. It's risky, I grant, but that's what the stakes are. Okay. I did that with every one of the five, and each one had a different, you know, brought me to a different place. William Carlos Williams, for example. Why did I do Williams? Well, my family, my mother's side of the family is from New Jersey. Okay, from the Patterson. So here I am, I'm going for my PhD, and I'm writing the Hopkins book. I walk into a bookstore in Queens, and I see a book, it's called Patterson. I said, who the hell would write about Patterson, New Jersey? And write a poem about Patterson, New Jersey, and write an epic about Patterson, New Jersey, where my grandmother used to work in the silk mills along the falls there, where my mother grew up. So I pick it up, and I don't understand it. You know, it's a complex book. But I'm fascinated by this, and so I keep going back to it. I keep going back to William Carlos Williams. And so when I started teaching at the University of Massachusetts back in 68, I had been trained in Victorian literature. So I thought I was going to be teaching Victorian literature, although I really wanted to teach modern poetry, okay? But they had told me, I had been counseled, do not try to go to modern. Everybody wants modern literature, so go back a little bit. Go back to the Romantics, or go back to the Victorians. So I went back to the Victorians. I get to UMass, and the first thing they say is, we'd like you to come here, but we already have a person at Victorian. Would you mind, teaching, you don't do this kind of thing anymore. Would you mind teaching modern poetry? And I said, mind? I said, don't throw me to the briar patch, you know. I said, I can hardly wait. And so that gave me the chance to go back to William Carlos Williams. And I remember reading, you know, teaching Williams and Pound and Eliot Wallace, and loving it, as well as all the classes in composition, by the way, that, you know, the beginning teachers do. And I remember a very nice teacher, a British woman, saying to me, Paul, we like you here, and we understand that you want to do a book on William Carlos Williams. I wish you would rethink that. He's really a minor poet, and you don't want to go in that direction. Think of Eliot or somebody or something like that. Well, that's all you had to do was challenge me with that. And I said, well, I will write the book, and I will try to put Williams on the map. I mean, that's the chutzpah of somebody who's 30 years old, okay? But that's what I began to think of doing, you know? And I remember Ellman had such a profound impact on me, his biography of James Joyce in particular, as well as the one on Oscar Wilde. But this huge book on this Irish writer, and I said, wow, I want to do that for an American. I want to do that for this guy, William Carlos Williams. That's why it's so big. I mean, he was trying to imitate Ellman. And you know, you get obsessed and you spend 10 years on it. And you have a little Corona typewriter, okay, that your wife gives you, you know. And you've got these little 3x5 cards, you know, and you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, and you're typing and typing and typing with two fingers. That's all I do. And you're doing this year after year, and then you're going down to the libraries at Yale and Harvard, and you're going up to to SUNY Buffalo, and you're going to the University of Texas, you know, and getting this fragment and getting this fragment, they're putting them side by side until the light begins to emerge, you see, and then you write, you can't get to every place, you can't get to Oklahoma, you can't get to Missoula, you know what I mean, so then you write letters, please, could I have your three letters, you know, copies of them, etc., and they, you begin, but it's fun, it's like a detective work, and you begin collecting all these pieces, that's how that's related. And then you know, after a while, at Yale, for example, Donald Gallup, who was a librarian down there, saying, yes, this is what we have. And then once he gets to trust you, that's when they tell you, oh, by the way, we also have these four boxes of letters that have not been cataloged. Do you think you'd be interested in, you know, in seeing them? And, you know, and that's what happens. And then, you know, and then whole new areas open up. Let me just say one other story about Williams. I remember at the end when I went to see his son, Dr. Williams Jr., William Eric Williams, who was a doctor in the same house as his father in Rutherford, New Jersey. And I remember going to see him the first time. I just drove down, and I saw him working in the garden, the same garden that his father had and his mother had, you know, worked in all these years. And I said, excuse me, you're Dr. Williams Jr., aren't you? And he said, yes, yeah. What do you want? You know? He's a busy doctor, right? I said, well, I'm writing this biography, you know, of your dad, and I wonder if I could see your mom, you know, talk to her, Flossie. He says, she's upstairs, but she's dying. She's dying. So, he said, if you had been here 2 weeks ago, he said, two flower children just came up to the front door, knocked on the door, and said, we'd like to talk to you, and she saw them. But I didn't have that chutzpah. So I never did meet Flossie, you know. I did meet Flossie's sister, the one that Williams first wanted to marry. And she was in her 90s. That was fascinating. And I went to the house, and she was bedridden. And I went to the house, and Ivan Earle is her son, and he's a painter. He's at the Metropolitan Museum, etc. And so he said, mother's in the next room, and she'll see you now. So I went in, and there she was. She was old. She had dolled herself up. She's in her 90s now, right? And she's bedridden. And she says, you're writing a book on Willie, huh? Why would anybody want to write a book about Willie? Almost like the next sentence should have been, why don't you write a book about me? So anyway, she was very, very, very interesting. So I did get a chance to talk to her to find out what the relationship was. Why? Because Williams had so much wanted to marry her, but his brother got in there first, and they were engaged, and then they broke up. And on a rebound, he married the sister, Flossie, and they were married for 50 years. Okay, so there's a really wonderful story there. Anyway, at the end, I said, you know, Doc, I've been up to... That's what we call William Carlos. That's what I called the son too. I said, Doc, you know, there are these letters that I need to see, and they were at Buffalo, but they were your mother. We called them, took them back, and they're private letters, I know. But I wonder if is there any way we could get access to them, right? He said, oh yeah. You mean those four huge boxes of letters that the dad wrote that mom thought were too private? You'd like to see those? Yeah, I'd like to see them. He said, I'll call him my brother Paul. He was living down in Manidolo, down in New Jersey, near Cape May. So, when you come back in a couple of weeks, we'll have them here for you. So I came back a month later, and over there in the dining room. Now, this is the same house that Williams and Floss lived in for 50 years, and this is where the son is living, right? And he's the caretaker of the estate. And he's got the four boxes over there on a little table, and they're all sealed. They haven't been opened since they were put away years before, since they were returned from Buffalo. Nobody has seen them. And he says, I got a question to ask you first. There's been some rumors that my father had an affair or several affairs. Is that true? I can't believe my father would do something like that. This is the test. Mm-hmm. So I say, it is true. It's the truth. That's what the letters, you know, et cetera. People have interviewed. It is the truth, but I know that he loved your mother very, very deeply, you know. And, you know, he was very sorry for the transgressions. And he said, I thought so. He said, here, you can have the letters. But that was the test. That was the test. Otherwise, they would have gone right back with Eurydice back into Hades, you know. So, and that, of course, made all the difference, you know, having those letters, because when Williams had a breakdown in 1953 during the McCarthy period, McCarthy army hearings, etc., and Williams was accused of being a communist and all of that, he was sent away to get electric shock treatment. All of this was available to me. It gave a whole new dimension to the complex humanity of this doctor, in the 1950s. So, and in each case, when I did the Berryman, the same thing. I had to go out to Minneapolis. I worked for months in the University of Minnesota with their manuscripts out there, the letters, etc. And Berryman's wife, Kate, was living right there in town, about a mile away. And she was very, very generous. You know, she showed me a lot of information. She was very, very helpful, and that makes all the difference in the world. Is to have the help of the family. Let me give you one example of why I didn't do one biography, okay, just to show you what else can happen. I wanted to write the life of Flannery O'Connor, okay? Mm-hmm. I wanted to do the life of Flannery O'Connor. I've always loved Flannery O'Connor's work, and I thought this would be a terrific life to do. And then I was at a conference in Milledgeville, the University of Georgia in Milledgeville, which is where Flannery O'Connor is buried. You know, that's where Andalusia is, you know, the home, where, you know, the farm that she had. And I remember there was a conference in which a young Jesuit got up. There were two Jesuits there, okay? And the younger one got up and gave a paper on Flannery O'Connor. And the one, she never married, okay? But there was this one time where it looked like, you know, she had a very serious significant other, okay? And what happened was, it was said because he was actually using her because of her name, okay? And so it didn't go, you know, the relationship didn't go anywhere. But soon after that event occurred, which she tried to keep, you know, you can understand, under wraps, right? She wrote this short story, Good Country People, the one about the woman with the wooden leg, okay, who goes up into the, you know, is lured by the Bible salesman up into a loft, and he says, I'd really like to see your wooden leg. Could you unstrap it for me? This is Flannery O'Connor. And so she takes her leg off and gives it to him, and he walks down the ladder with the leg, okay? But that incident, that story, that dark story in which he just walks off, was based, according to what the young Jesuit was writing, on the relationship that had failed, okay? And I remember after I thought it was a very good talk, but I remember the young Jesuit walked out the back door and just disappeared. I wondered, why did he do that? And then I saw Pat Samway, another Jesuit, who was in the back, and I saw Flannery O'Connor's cousin, who had authority over the papers, all the papers, and looked like a character out of Flannery O'Connor, with a kind of flower hat and all, you know. And she's back there and she's saying, where did that young man go? I want to talk to him right now. You know, he's not going to publish that. And Pat Samway saying, look, you know, we're professionals. You know, he has every right to do this. And she said, I'll stop it, you know. And she probably did. And I said to myself, I'm not going there. You know, I'm not going to do Flannery. There are certain things that happen in biography that you say to yourself, it's not worth 5 years, you know. Sort of like what happened with Ian Hamilton when he tried to do the biography of J.D. Salinger, who was a recluse, right? And worked and worked and worked on that and got nowhere. And finally, even though he had permission to use the papers with the University of Texas, and he had the whole thing, it was in print, it was in galleys, and J.D. Salinger's lawyer got in touch with him and said, you can't use it. He said, but I had permission. He said, no, you can't. Mr. Salinger says you can't use it. You can only paraphrase. So he goes through the whole process of rewriting and having it reprinted with paraphrase. And Salinger still says, I'll sue you if you publish it. So he was stymied. He really couldn't do anything. What he finally did was to write a book, not about J.D. Salinger, but in search of J.D. Salinger. That was the closest he could come. And then he said, I will never write a biography of a living human being as long as I live. And he went back, you know, to do kinds of Boswellian, you know, lives, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, these are some of the, but each case has been, has brought its own, I think I've talked long enough. But the same thing is true with when I did Robert Lowell. I can still remember going up to the house on 67th Street, West 67, to talk to Elizabeth Hardwick, Lowell's second wife. And I go in there, and I know she hates biographers. I know it. But still, I've got to talk to her. And I know she hates biographers because Ian Hamilton had written a biography, and she said, he should never have written it. Who does he think he is? And so there I go. I go up to the apartment. She's invited me down. I go into the room, and she's watching television. She's watching the tennis matches. And she refuses to turn the television off while I interview her. So she says, you know, there are priorities. And the priority was, you know. But she seemed to be very amenable. She was very helpful. She called me a number of times and said, can you help me with this? Can you help me with that? And I did what I could. And then when the book was published, I found out that in one of the New York papers, she said, oh, that idiot Mariani. You know? And then the reporter asked, you're calling Mariani an idiot? She said, well, no, he's not really an idiot, but he's a hard-working guy, and he shouldn't have written this biography. So, you know, you can't win. You can't win in certain cases. And of course, Hart Crane was a fascinating study. Learning all about New York City. What New York? Not the New York of the 50s. That is, East 50th. Not that, but way down in the village. You know, which still maintains some of its older, you know, older architecture. And walking the Brooklyn Bridge, the East River, catching up with. There were very few. By this point, nobody, virtually no. Every the last person that was alive had just died at 100. So there was nobody on that generation that I could speak to about it, which is both a blessing, in a way, you know, as well as a curse. But I tell you, you talk to five or six different people, like with Williams especially, and you get five or six different stories, and it's not like you can reconcile. You somehow got to take one story or not the other. One final story, and then I'm going to stop you. This is what happened with Hopkins. Okay, the biographies of Hopkins, they've always made him more eccentric than he really was, I think, okay? And I said, you know, and a number of us were asking, what happened? What's happening here? Well, Father Schlatter, who's an 80-year-old Jesuit out there in Gonzaga, did a real service. He started studying the documents to see if there was some kind of source that was creating these stories. And he did. He found it. And it turned out to be another Jesuit. Okay, yeah. He found another Jesuit who had been with Hopkins in University College Dublin in the 80s and had filtered out, you know, or given out these stories, which were not true. He didn't like Hopkins because Hopkins had remained pretty much a British citizen and in support of the government, although he saw also that in Ireland, it was time for home rule. After spending 6 months there, he saw at ground zero that it was time for a political change. He saw that. And that was not something easy for Hopkins, but he saw it, and he told Bridges, and he told the others, and he said, it's only a matter of time. It's got to happen. There's no other answer to this. But this particular Jesuit started telling stories about him, and they filtered in. They got into all of the material, and what we've had to do is erase them. You know, it's like a virus. Because they're not substantiated. Now, I haven't gone into depth. I didn't spend a whole essay doing that. But I just had to, you know, sort of go through those files and get rid of those stories that Schlatter had shown were did not work. And it gives you a whole different, what it does, it's sort of like having a painting, say there's some blues and greens, and then somebody puts a red in there, you know, that doesn't belong, I mean. And you got to go through it carefully and take out all that red and acid, you know. Anyway, I could go on and on and on. I'm going to stop. I'm just going to open it up. Yes, please. Yeah.
Just a question of that. Yes. I had another question.
Sure.
I wanted to ask you about the biography. Yeah. That Jesuit was talking to people in the 1920s, so he was one of the people.
That's correct. It was still
Hopkins.
That's correct.
I thought what I had read was that the stories were true, but it was his antagonism toward Hopkins that magnified their significance. Now, you're saying the stories themselves were...
Oh, the stories themselves were so exaggerated. So what, you know, if you exaggerated that
tell
much...
about blowing pepper through the keyhole.
Yeah, that kind of thing. We have, yes, that's the kind of story. Like, he says he caught Hopkins one time while there was a meeting going on in a room this size, okay? And the doors were closed, and they were talking about the future of the college. And the story is that Hopkins was outside with pepper and a bellows, and he was blowing pepper into the keyhole, and then he was watching them sneeze. You know? So that's kind of eccentric, you know? But there's no validation for it, you know. I know that Hopkins did certain things, but that's so unlike. See, that's the thing you have to do. You have to say, okay, there's this story, this story, this story, this story, you know, and do they match with anything that he wrote? Do they match with any other stories like it? And at a certain point, you know, you make your choice and you say, well, it's an interesting story. I could have put it in. Norman White put it in. But I sort of said, that's not Hopkins. That's not what I'm really after, you know.
Yeah. And the question I did want to ask you is, how do you deal with Hopkins' sexuality?
How do I deal with it? Well, you know, this is a lot of people are always asking, you know, okay, was Hopkins gay, okay? So then you ask yourself, okay, first of all, the word gay did not exist in Hopkins' time. So was he homosexual? Well, you mean actively homosexual? Did he ever act upon it? As far as we know, never. Never. He was, as a boy in hiding, I think attracted to another boy. But this was much more common in Victorian all-male schools. You know, it doesn't have the same connotations that it would have.
Dolben?
I'm sorry?
You mean Dolben?
Well, there's Dolben, too. Now, you know, the thing is, look...
That was at Balliol.
I'm sorry?
That was at Balliol.
Yes. No, I'm talking about Haggit, okay? I'm talking about Hopkins... Oh, two things. First, Hopkins kept a journal of his time at Haggit. And then he decided that he was going to burn that journal. So he burned it. What he did is he quoted from that journal, and he talks about a young man about a year younger than him, and he talks to him, and he says, you know, why aren't you talking to me anymore? This kind of thing, okay? And he said, and he says, he gave me a kind of bitter smile, and that was the end of that relationship, and I will be very careful in the future who I call my friend, that kind of thing. So, but the journal out of which that came, he burned. We just happened to have that because he included that in another letter, okay? Now, Digby Dolben, that's the big one. In fact, Patty Kitchener wrote a biography years ago, which is based, the whole book is based on his relationship to Digby Dolben. The whole book. His whole life is shaped by Digby Dolben. Now, then you say, okay, he meets Digby Dolben, who's, 18 years old at the time? He's younger than Hopkins, right? Hopkins is like in his first year at Balliol, okay? Or his second year, maybe, I forget now exactly, but somewhere in between there, okay? So he's 19, and Digby Dolben's 18, and he's fascinated by Dolben. And he says that he's often fascinated by faces, you know, by plants, by trees. I mean, that's the way he talks about it. So Dolben is a rather strange character in many ways. He's very intelligent, but he's very fey in a sense. Okay, for example, at one point he's flirting with the idea of young Digby, who comes from a kind of minor nobility. Okay, and he's a relative of Bridges. That's how Robert Bridges. You see, that's how he got to meet Dolben. He was Bridges' cousin. Dolben. And it was in Bridges' rooms that when Hopkins went to see Bridges, he met Digby Dolben. And he only met him one time. Only once. Yeah, that's right. Just once, that's all. I know you're puzzled by that, but that's all he met. He just met him one time. He later carried on a correspondence with him for a while and shared poems with him, so that we have among Hopkins's scraps, we have a few poems by Digby Dolben, just as among Digby Dolben's papers, we have a few of Hopkins' early work, okay? But he only met him one time. And in fact, and he was fascinated by it. But Digby Dolben, this is the kind of guy that Digby Dolben was. He decided he was going to become a Franciscan mystic. So he dressed up at 19. And he dressed up in a brown Franciscan robe.
The only time.
And walked through the streets of Birmingham barefooted, okay? Now, this is rather strange, you know, in 1864, 65, to be doing this kind of thing, okay? But that's the kind of... He wanted to get into a Balliol, and at one point... And then when it came time, he had been tutored, you know, he had private tutors. He came up to Balliol to take the exam, the entrance exams to get into Balliol, and he fainted. Okay? And... and did not take the exams and did not get into Balliol. So he's a little bit of a flighty guy, okay? And in fact, at one point, Bridges writes to Hopkins during the long vacation, you know, in the summers, and Bridges says to him, Digby's coming up, for a visit. Would you like to come up and meet him? He says, as much as I'd like to, I'm not going to. Okay? So whatever it was, whatever the attraction was, he wasn't going to. And then later, Bridges, what happened was Digby Dolben drowned. He drowned. It was like a year later. Was it suicide? Was it, we don't know, really know. But they found his body floating in a small river, and he was buried. And Hopkins did say at one point, I should like to see that, you know, his grave site sometime, okay? Not that he ever did, but he did say he would like to. And he did have a friend who was a friend of Dolben's when he got back from Switzerland, just before he joined the Jesuits. And the friend met him in London, and they did, among other things, they talked about Digby Dolben. Now, that's the evidence that we have. And out of that evidence, Patty Kitchen writes about the deep-seated homosexuality of Hopkins. I'm not so sure. I mean, I'm not saying it's not. I just don't think that that's sufficient evidence. We certainly know that he never in any way broke his vows in any way as a Jesuit. He did watch others. I mean, one of the things I was able to uncover, if I may, just tell this one story, because it stunned me. I always wondered why, in 1885, he wrote in the middle of these sonnets, these sonnets of desolation, why he suddenly wrote a poem about "To Watch Serves Mortal Beauty." And we know the date, because, he put the date on it. And a few days later, he writes "Carrion Comfort." So we know that these two poems are written, and so I checked it out. They were both written while he was on retreat. And what had happened, and I was able to put the pieces together, and here's what I think happened. He had a very close friend that he, in fact, the fellow who had brought him over from Anglicanism, or helped him come over from Anglicanism through the Oxford movement to Roman Catholicism, a fellow named William Addis, okay? Now, Addis was a little bit older than Hopkins, and Addis also became a priest, and then they saw each other occasionally, and they apparently had a correspondence. But both men destroyed each side of the correspondence. So all we have are little fragments. We have a couple of letters, that's it. Like a letter to Hopkins saying, "Dear Jared," that's how, by the way, how you say his name, Jared. I know I'm going to say Gerard Manley Hopkins, but it's Jared. "Come on down, and we've got a place for you here in the side room, at the oratory here, the London Oratory, the same order of Newman's, right? Except that this is the London rather than the Birmingham." And so he goes down there, and Hopkins was always very careful not to spread gossip, not to spread any kind of scandal. Very, very careful. But he gives a sermon which is out of time. In other words, it's not the sermon you would expect for that week. And it's about being careful not to spread scandal. Now, here's what I think happened. There was a woman in the parish where Father Addis was stationed, okay? And she didn't like Addis's sermons. So what she was doing was sitting in the pews with a notebook and trying to get all the evidence that she could and then she was going to turn it over to the bishop, okay? And Addis knew that she was doing this, and of course that makes you uncomfortable when you're giving a sermon, okay? So there was that. But then I think something else happened, because Hopkins alluded to it only later on, and that's this. Addis says, "You know what, Jared, I've got to be honest with you. I've been sleeping with one of the parishioners, okay? I've been having an affair with one of my parishioners." And so Hopkins tries to advise him. "You know, you can't do that. You know, obviously you can't. You're a priest, you know? There's nothing wrong with marriage, etc., but this is not for you. You've taken a vow, of chastity." And he tries to talk some sense into Addis, and then he has to return to Dublin. And while he's on retreat in Dublin, he writes this poem about "To What Serves Mortal Beauty." in which he tries to say, what is this attraction that we have? What is this deep erotic attraction that we have for others? And of course, what Hopkins says is, it tells us something about the splendor of God, that God could create something so beautiful that it could knock you off your feet. You know what I mean? As well as trees and flowers, but a beautiful woman can do this, you see, or a handsome man. So, and that's why he writes that poem at that time. I think it was his way of dealing with that issue, because within a year, Addis had left the parish, married the woman, but stayed in the parish. And Hopkins said, I wish he would have moved somewhere else, you know, simply because he had been the parish priest of that. Yeah, so that's something that no one else has written about, which I simply discovered, and it gives a more human face to Hopkins, you know. Can I give you one other story like this? Because these are so fascinating, these new stories that come out. There's a story, there was another Jesuit named Marcus Klein. He was German. And he was a very intelligent man. He had come over from the English province, even though he was... did I say he was German? I had a German name, I'm sorry. He was French, but his name was Marcus Klein. And he had served as a young surgeon in the French army, okay? And then had a vocation and become a Jesuit priest. And the Irish Jesuits were looking for the best Jesuits that they could get to staff the college there in Dublin. Hopkins was one. Marcus Klein came over a year later. Now, one of the things the Jesuits were told was, stay out of politics. Stay out of politics. There's a lot of Irish national feeling going on right now, and you don't want to get caught up in the middle of it. Just do your work. It's funny because at one point, Hopkins writes a letter and he says, you know, Parnell has been after me to come and see him, you know, but he says, I'm going to be busy tonight unspearing the universe. In other words, I'm not going. I'm staying away from this. This is dangerous. But not so with Marcus Klein. Father Marcus Klein is told definitely he's a member of the British province, and he's in Ireland. So his real superior is still, you know, is still the British provincial in Farm Street. And so they tell him, look, don't go to this gathering. It's a very charged meeting, and the Prince Edward is there, you know, has for the first time in 20 years, you know, there's been an English presence in Ireland, okay? Although they spend every summer, he says, in Scotland, they don't come over to Ireland, you know? Marcus Klein goes, he talks with some of the mucky mucks, and word gets back, and he's in real trouble. He was told not to do this, okay? So he goes back, so he gets a letter from his own provincial, saying, Marcus, get back here. Get back to London. You know, you really stepped over the line. You've caused a lot of, you know, political issues here. Marcus Klein does go back. Father Klein goes back to London and sits down with the provincial. And the provincial says, you know, you were told not to do this. You know, you were in direct disobedience to what we told you to do. None of the other Jesuits went. You know, they all stayed away, but except for Marcus Klein, because he was a wheeler dealer. He always saw himself as a wheeler dealer. And so they say, you're going to have to stay here for a while. You're going to have to be, in some sense, chastised. He says, no, I'm not. He said, excuse me? Why not? He said, because I'm not really a Jesuit. I'm sorry? He said, I never told you this, but I was never baptized. I was never baptized, so I'm not really a Christian. And therefore, I can't very well be a Jesuit.
Why not?
Go ahead, please.
Paul, just to make the argument, maybe to follow on.
Yes. Sure.
No, the Jesuits say out of politics in Ireland.
Yes.
They did and they didn't.
Yeah. What?
They did and they didn't.
Yes. Oh, I know. Oh, yes, absolutely.
For example, yeah. But the uprising in 1916, on Easter Monday,
yes,
it was Jesuits who came in and gave absolution to the men.
Sure.
When other priests had refused,
yeah,
you know, they had a curse to a young Irish Catholic,
yeah,
taking his life in his hands.
Absolutely. Without
absolution, you know.
Yes.
Because my dad was among them.
What? And what do you mean? Your father was there?
He was.
In 1916?
1916. And wow. it was the Clongowes, it was the Clongowes Jesuits who actually came.
Yes, Clongowes would, yeah.
And gave absolution.
Wow.
It was Rollins Mill, actually. But most of the men of 1916 had attempted to go to confession before the
uprising.
Before the uprising.
Yeah.
And but were refused. The local priests had refused them. It was the Clongowes Jesuits.
Yeah, who went out. Well, it's very complicated, and I'm glad they did that. You know, and that's the other side.
But my question would be, why was he buried in Glasnevin?
Because he died. You know, he died in Ireland, they just buried him there. That's it. They had the funeral at what's the big church on the big Jesuit church presence in Dublin. I can't remember. Gardner Street, what they call the Gardner Street, the Gardner Street church. There was a funeral mass there, and then they took him right up to Glasnevin and buried him there. And there's his name, P. Gerardus M. Hopkins, P for Pater, Pater Gerard Manley Hopkins. And there it is, no way they were going to, why bring him back? He was among his own, right?
And also his parents had made it to Dublin in time before he died.
His parents, the only time in their lives that his parents ever attended any Jesuit presence, they never attended any of his masses, they never attended his ordination, any of it.
But his mother, but it was interesting, in detail, apparently in Victorian times, women did not attend funerals. His mother did not attend the funeral.
Yes, that's right. His father did. But I mean, he was there. They were both there at his deathbed. Where he was dying there, on the first floor there, what they call the first floor in Ireland, at 85 St. Stephen's Green. That's right. And Alan, please. Sure.
I have two questions.
One, sure.
Have you ever been attracted to Evelyn Waugh?
Evelyn Waugh? Yeah. No, I might as well. I'll be honest with you. No. No, but I'll tell you. I like Evelyn Waugh. In fact, here's the problem. Here's the problem. Okay, something I didn't mention is notice that all five of the figures that I did are poets, right?
Well, you mentioned Flannery.
I did. That's Flannery O'Connor. No. That's right. But she's an exception. I have a very deep affection for Flannery O'Connor. Okay.
Just
Well, I like Ward, but you have to more than just like them. I mean, if you're going to give up 5 to 10 years of your life, right, you better like that person. If you don't, it's sort of like with, what was it, the biographer of Robert Frost, what's his name, Thompson, right? Thompson spent all those years on men that he hated. Lawrence Thompson. All those years writing a multi-volume life of a poet that he came to despise. And it shows in the book. Why do that? I mean, he had started out liking Frost, and then he got to know him better. but he still continued to write. After Frost's death, he still wrote, and he brought it out 3 volumes. And right across the line, people have said, why? Why spend all this time on someone that you despise, Maybe it was a way of getting even with him. You know what I mean? Like he would have the last word. But the other thing, Alan, I want to mention is this. I never went to a place like Breadloaf School, not the Breadloaf School, but the Breadloaf Writers Conference. I never went, or never thought I'd even gone to a place like the Irish Writers Conference. But I wanted to write poetry. So how was I going to learn about poetry? I didn't know poets, okay, in my generation. But if I could go to the Beinecke, I could actually have Williams's manuscripts right in front of me. I could see where the corrections were made. And if I studied the corrections, I could see why he was doing what he was doing. In fact, my first book was, I was afraid to become a biographer. Who the hell was I to be, coming from a working class family in New York, who was I to become a biographer, right? So I remember thinking, I know, I'll do the next best thing. I'll write a biography of Patterson, just the book, just in other words, how he came to write that book. So I sent in a manuscript, the outline, to Oxford University Press and said, would you be interested, I was like 32, 33 years old, something like that. And I said, would you be interested in this? And he said, no. He said, no, we're not interested in that. But if you are interested in writing a full-length biography of William Carlos Williams, that's different. We'll give you $1,000.
10 years of your life.
I'm interested.
You know, we can give you $1,000 up front, you know. How about that? Anyway, I said, when do I have to let you know? He said, you got 48 hours. So I said, I'll do it. I just said, I'll do it, you know, and then you figure out how you're going to do it. But it was like a validation, because now I had someone who was interested in my writing the biography, which I myself was afraid to ask to do. And that was James Rames, and then he left Oxford, and he asked me to come with him to another press, and I said, no, I'll stay with Oxford University Press. And then what finally happened, though, is that that fell apart, and someone else was willing to give me $3,000.
Wait long enough.
Right. And that was Houghton Mifflin. So I said, all right, okay. So I made the transfer, gave him back the $1,000, and picked up $3,000. And then that poor editor had a drinking problem. I mean, this is some of the things that happened. And then
he's real behind the scenes.
and then he disappeared. And then someone else, a woman, took it over. And we finally, you know, Peggy Shukuhira, and we got, you know, we got through it, you know. But that's a story in itself, just what happens when you try to wrestle, like with Jacob's Angel, with your editors, you know. Do you bully them? Or do they bully you? You know, what's give and take? You know, what do you find, you know, and it's always, it's a kind of compromise. But as you get older, you say, well, there's certain things I won't compromise on. There's certain things that have to be done. Do you know what I mean? The one I think I compromised too much on, for me, was The Berryman. I'll tell you why. That was my first... See, the thing was, when The Williams came out, it hit the front page of the New York Times. That was great. I mean, that was very important in terms of my agent saying, okay, you're going to make some more money next time. Yeah, and that's important when you're raising a family, you know what I mean? So sure enough, they said, okay, what do you want to do? And I said, I'll do Robert Lowell. But what happened was I started to do Robert Lowell, and then I had a dream. And John Berryman came in, and he pushed Lowell out. He said, get out of here. He said, Mariani's going to do me, and then he'll do you. And so really, so I woke up, I said, I'm doing Berryman. And I asked the editor if I could change from Lowell to Berryman, because I said, there's so much in Berryman that needs to be said, and then I can do Lowell. And she said, okay, you know, we can do that. But the problem was, when I did The Berryman, there's an awful lot of, quote, juicy stuff. And I'm not interested in that, except insofar as it tells us about the poem. I'm not that, I don't like that, you know. I mean, it's there, and you got to talk about it, but I mean, because I know biographers who will tell you, I want to find the juiciest stuff, and I'm going to write about that, and that's how I'm going to sell my book. I'm serious about this, you know, and I know that this happens. But if I use it, I need it in order to explain why, say, Berryman is writing Homage to Mrs. Bradstreet or something like that, you know, that kind of thing. Okay. Well, what happened was the book was about 250 pages over the length of what it was supposed to be. And I thought, well, they'll love me so much that they'll let me do it. That's not the way it works, folks. Not in New York. So she said, we're going to have to cut this. I said, all right. She said, I'm going to cut it for you, okay? So she started cutting most of the scholarship, you know, and keeping too much, I think, of the other stuff. And we fought back and forth, but she was tough. She was a wrestler. So finally, we had to compromise in ways that I wasn't really fully happy with. And so more of that came in than I would have liked. And I vowed, though, at that time, I said, this will never happen again. What comes first is the intellectual life, is the spiritual life, and then, you know, then the other. And but that was the one place where I think I had to make a kind of compromise. Yeah.
Paul, I look forward to reading your book, and I'm wondering if in there you have any discussion about Hopkins' relationship to Walt Whitman.
I do.
Famously said to, I guess, Bridges, I'm most like him.
Yes.
I'm more like him than anybody else living. And to paraphrase, I'm ashamed of that because he's not a very nice man.
Right.
You
right.
know, what does that really mean?
Yeah.
Tell me what your take is.
Yeah, yeah. This is a complex one. Let's try it, okay? Here's Walt Whitman writing in America, right? And he comes out with Leaves of Grass in 1855 when Hopkins is 11 years old, okay? And it goes through successive editions. And
Meanwhile, the generation just after Hopkins's at Balliol includes Oscar Wilde. You know, okay, so you're getting a different take on the aesthetics of Walter Pater. You know, Walter Pater was the tutor of both Hopkins and then the tutor of Oscar Wilde. And what you're getting is a really a flaunting forth, I think, you know, of the gay agenda, you know, with Oscar Wilde and Swinburne and Pater himself. You know, by the way, I don't know if you know this about Pater, but Jowett, who was the found out that Pater in fact had written compromising letters to a student and used that against him. He said, "You're never gonna, you know, really get ahead here because I've got the goods on you." Do you know what I mean? So that kept kind of Pater kind of squashed a bit, you know. There's that world, you know, around Hopkins and around Whitman. So what happens is Whitman takes on a life of his own in England, somewhat different from the life that he has in America. In Britain, they're saying, here's our guardian, here's the figure that we can follow, you know, the young homosexual crowd. I'm sorry?
Based
on the Calamus poems. In fact, you know, Whitman lost his job in Washington because of the Calamus poems, right? I mean, he left a copy of the book on his desk, and his boss saw it and fired him. Fired him! You know, just, that was it, okay? So, and Whitman himself is a bit uncomfortable with this himself. You know, he's not, quote, flamboyant or flagrant. But, you know, Oscar Wilde came to the United States to see Walt Whitman. So you have a kind of Whitmanian cult that's grown up by the 70s. And if you look at some of the essays in the various quarterlies, you know, the literary reviews, you find that there's a kind of subtext in terms of, hey, folks, if you're looking for the real inside, guys, you know what I'm talking about, Whitman is the one that you want to read. Okay, so there is this whole thing going on. Now, the thing is... You look at a poem like The Leaden Echo and The Golden Echo by Hopkins, and this is, by the way, this is the poem that Bridges read and said, Whitman, huh? Whitman. And this is where, you know, Hopkins says, you know, I have to admit that, in many ways I feel closest to, of any poet living, to Walt Whitman. Now, of course, then you read that, well, does that mean that he's also saying, you know, is it because of the gay agenda as well, okay? My own sense is, that he's aware of that. In fact, I think he wrote a poem about this, which I've explicated, called Andromeda, in which he speaks about the wilder beast from West, which I think may be a pun on the name Oscar Wilde as well, okay? But from West, in other words, from Wilde's mentor, okay? And what he's talking about is the new, what should we call it, the new rampant secular, Song of Myself. Okay, that's the important thing. Song of Myself. Okay, that Whitman is singing. Song of Myself. Because Hopkins, in his spiritual note, says the worst thing we can do is sing the self. He said that's what Lucifer did. You know, you see what I mean? You see where he's coming from? From a theological perspective, he says, and then he's got this great theophany in which he says, okay, what was it like before the fall? And Hopkins, and he says, well, it was like this, insofar as he can imagine it. There's, you know, God has created the universe, right? Created the angelic choruses. And he sees them as a huge choir. And they're singing. They're all singing, and you have to sing in harmony if you're going to sing in a choir. You can't go, ba ba boom, ba ba boom. You know, I mean, you all sing the same notes, right? So, but Lucifer starts singing, and he says, hey, I have a great voice. I have a great voice. Who needs him? Meaning the creator. Who needs God? So then he starts singing out of sync, and he creates a cacophony. And other angels say, hey, I like this guy. I'm going to follow this. This is how he imagines, you know, like a choir going amok, is how he imagines the first break, you know, in the fall, pride, okay? So, and Hopkins says, what's the big problem here? The big sin here is pride, is not looking at the other as a creature, the creator, but looking at oneself as though one had self-created oneself, which one hasn't. And paying homage to oneself instead of to the one who gave you life. And this is very important to Hopkins because it means a kind of radical kenosis or emptying of himself that's so important to his own spiritual development. And that's the image of Christ, you know, the idea of a radical emptying, a kind of spiraling downward mobility throughout life until the cross. You see what I mean? So there's that. So Whitman, for him, stands on the other side. He stands with Carlyle. He stands with Emerson. You know, he stands with that kind of American romanticism, which he sees as a kind of outbreak from what he sees as one of the major errors for him as a convert, the non-Serbian of the Reformation as well. Okay, does this make sense what I'm saying here?
It does.
Yeah.
I have a slightly different take.
Sure.
But yes, it does. What you're saying.
Yeah.
There are many ways you can look at that statement.
Absolutely.
One of the most provocative statements.
Yes, it is. And in another place, he says even Whitman can serve the wounded in Washington. You know what I mean? So you've got these statements about Whitman, who he both admired. He also tells Bridges, look, Bridges, you know, I'm not like Whitman in terms of my style. The thing with Whitman is that he's like the Rocky Mountains, he says. He's like the Rocky Mountains, by which he means that the stuff is prose, is really prose that started out with a kind of underlying a shadow of iambic pentameter, you know, or the epic line, but has moved so much away from it that it's moving towards a new kind of prose, sort of like the Wild West. He sees that as the kind of metaphorical template for, you know, for this landscape. He says, but not me. He says, for me, I've measured every single note with my sprung rhythm, you know, with my alliterations, etc., with my understanding of Pythagoras, with my understanding of Augustine's De Musica. You see what I mean? So he says, I can defend every single note. Whitman can. He says, now that doesn't mean that Whitman's a bad poet, but you can't have it both ways. So in that sense, he's lawless. Whereas I'm following laws all the way through, you see. So it goes psychologically that deep in terms of the poetics of the both of them, you see.
Well, obviously there's lots to talk about here. And unfortunately we don't have lots of extra time. We've come to the end of our time. But help me thank Professor Mariani.